All right. Well, here we go. First off, I wanted to say thanks to Chuck and Harriet for hosting everything. So they've been taking care of everything in the background. Big thanks to Luke in the back, who's making sure that everything's working. So Luke, thanks a lot. He was also one of my Joshua students, so he's keeping check on if I'm telling you truth. So I appreciate that, Luke. Thank you. tonight, I wanted to give you a story. And, you know, because again, I told my son I'd give you stories. So here comes one. Comes from my Joshua days. We take students every month on a different missions experience. So we'd be traveling all the time. We'd be in places like Mexico for a week or two. We'd be down in, we'd go to Israel for 2 weeks. We'd go to Dominican Republic. We'd go do street evangelism, different places. So one particular year, we were making our way out to Las Vegas to go do street evangelism on the strip in Las Vegas. So we were driving, and we would always stay on the way there at a camp that's really cool out there called Ironwood. And we would stay for the night, and they would put us up and like let us go horseback riding. We'd have a lot of fun and just hang out in their place. So we're there, we overnight, and then the next morning, as I'm walking through the camp with their leader, one of my students shows up, and he's caught this giant chuckwalla lizard. Like this big, I mean, it was big. And he's like grinning from ear to ear, like, look what I caught. You know, and we're like, that's awesome. Caleb, please put it away, you know, like go put it back into the wild. And the guy who ran the camp said, hey, that's really cool that you caught him. Could you please leave him here? Because this is his natural habitat. And I thought that was the end of the story. So we got in the vans, drove to Vegas. We're there for 6 days doing street evangelism, drove all the way back to Hume Lake. We got to the gas pumps and we were filling up our vans. And all of a sudden, Caleb gets out of his van, opens up his backpack, and he's like, we made it, buddy. And he's holding the chuckwalla. And I'm like looking at him going, number one, that means that lizard was running loose in his hotel room in Vegas. That means that lizard's been in his backpack doing who knows what. And it also means that he totally like went against what the guy who ran that camp out in Barstow told him to do. And I just looked at him and I'm all, you got to be kidding me. He's like, what? I'm like, oh man, I am not happy about this. He goes, what are you going to do? I'm like, give me a minute. So I like kind of walk away for a second because I'm like, I got to get my composure. Part of Joshua with students is helping them learn. I call them teachable moments. So I'm like, all right, Lord, give me this teachable moment. What's it going to be? So I walk back and I go, all right, as of right now, you're kicked out of Joshua. And he's like looking at me with his eyes open. I go, unless you return that chuckwalla to Barstow. He's like, right now? I'm all, yep. He's like, I don't have a car. I go, I know. You're going to have to figure this out. So this kid had to get a ride with our Hume Lake truck driver who drives to Fresno each week. He had to catch a ride with him to Fresno to the train station, where he then caught a nice little train ride all the way out to Barstow, where he then walked out into the desert a little ways, let the chuckwalla go, and came back. And I made him give me photos of the entire thing so that I could see that he was actually there, you know? And he came back, and I let him stay in the program, but I'm sitting there going, hey, buddy, there are consequences, man, and the consequence of you taking that chuckwalla is that you're going to return it. So he then wrote a song because he was a musician, and he entitled it Chuckwalla Blues, and where he tells the story of his train ride and all the people he met on the way to go return the chuckwalla. So the fun stories of things that happen. All right, tonight, a couple of people have asked me about resources. So later this evening, Luke's going to put up a slide that shows you a couple of books that I would recommend so you can write those down when we finish tonight. One of those books, like I said, it's called Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. It's sitting up here if you want to come take a look at it. I saw that they had one in the gift shop or store over there. I don't know how many they had, and I don't know if it's been bought. So they got four? Six. Three. Hey, just go buy one. Yeah, it sounds like they have some over there. You can find them on Amazon and pick one up if you want to. Also, some people are asking me, like, is there a curriculum or anything like that? And I'm not here to, like, sell stuff, but there are curriculums. And so can you go to the website really quick? If you go to gtitours.org, which is our website, and this is where all of our trips are and all that kind of stuff. And if you go to a section called Study and you click on that, it's going to take you to a curriculum that you can purchase if you want to. Anyone who does a trip with us gets it for free. It's part of, we want everyone who goes on a trip to Israel to be prepared. But you also have the ability to get the course there too. So if you're looking for something, I'm not saying it's the best one out there. It's me teaching, I'm sorry. But that is an option that's there. And feel free if you want to pick something like that up, or if you end up ever going on a trip with us, you get it for free. So it's something that's included. So that's an option that's there. What else do we got? Tonight up here up front, if you want to come up, you can see the different study guides and stuff that we do with our trips. My business card's up here if you've got questions and you want to email me later and be like, hey, what was this all about? Or you've got questions on Israel, grab one of these. I'd love to answer those for you. And then we've got two brochures up here. There are trips out there that you guys, if you're interested, can get on. But these two trips right here are for people in ministry. So if you go back and you know a pastor or a youth pastor or someone of that nature, and you just want to find a way to help bless them, we run two trips a year, one to Turkey, where we do the basically footsteps of Paul. So we follow Paul's missionary journeys, and we also do the seven churches of Revelation with a New Testament bend to it, and then we do one that goes to Israel. But this is a great time to get ministry people there. We underwrite the cost and make it as cheap as we possibly can because we want to bless guys and girls who are in ministry and give them a chance to see these things as they're teaching them. So I'd love for you, if you know someone like that, it's a very limited space, but again, I love telling people that so that you can tell somebody and just be like, hey, I think it'd be really cool if you got a chance to go. And what I love watching is churches a lot of times will come alongside their pastor or their executive pastor or their youth pastor and just go, we want to help get you there. You pay for half, we'll pay for half, and let's get you over there to have this experience that hopefully will change the way they teach and how they read the Bible. If you want to go, we got room for that too, but I'm not here at Hume Lake to sell things, so that's just an option to tell people about. All right, here we go. We're going to give a couple things away. So the first hand up, let me tell you what you're winning right now. This right here is a universal plug adapter because my assumption is you're going to travel if you win this. This allows you anywhere in the world to plug your device in and charge it up so that you can keep taking photos. This is an important thing. So first person I see who kind of raised their hands already up. All right, what's the answer? Jesus. He wins, it's Jesus. It's always Jesus, right? All right, so the question is this. What are the three cities of the religious triangle area? You got it. Nicely done. There you go. All right, we'll do one more right here. This here is a passport holder because I'm assuming you're going to travel. And you're going to need a passport holder. And I'm assuming you're going to travel and you need an indestructible luggage tag that your luggage will die, but these will not. So at least you'll see these come rolling through. So the question is going to be this. Name for me, besides the religious triangle, I want the names of the other three groupings of people who are in the Galilee area. Right on. Woo. All right, now you got to travel with that. We'll do one more maybe tonight when we do the milkshake, so that'll work out good. All right, as we get ready to jump into this, Luke's got a video he's going to throw up there for us because, again, I think it's good to keep seeing the land. And so here's a little video that has the land in it. Luke, it's not there. It's beautiful, though. It's good music. Well, the land's beautiful. We'll just teach without it. Maybe we'll figure that out. It's probably my fault. Mac computers, you know, they're the best, but at the same time, something happened. All right, so here we go. We're going to jump into where we were yesterday. Are we ready for slides? Shema. We got to say it one time together. Is anybody ready to say it in Hebrew on their own? Shema, well done. All right, here we go. So repeat after me. Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu. Adonai Echad. Shema Israel. Adonai Eloheinu. Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel. The Lord is our God. The Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And let's add what Jesus added to it, and love your neighbor as yourself. Well done. All right, tomorrow, giving out a backpack for someone who wants to come up here and actually say that from the stage with proper Hebrew spitting is what we're looking for. All right. Yesterday, we started out in the Galilee. We're going to be in the Galilee tonight, and we're going to work our way around it and make some time there. So we're going to use the same map. So if you labeled the map yesterday, then you're set. If you didn't label the map yesterday, just raise your hand. We can give you a map if you don't have one. But we are going to label up the Galilee region one more time. So who needs maps? All right, maps are on their way. Unless we're out of them in the back. I got plenty. That's what I love about Chuck. Always prepared. Yeah. So we're going to just briefly and quickly go through, again, the Galilee area and do a little bit of review. And then we're going to jump into where we left off yesterday with those disciples. All right, so here we go. This is a filled out map. We kind of already talked about this, and I'll pull everything up again. But remember, you got Susita over here on this side. This is the Decapolis. Going to the northern part of Galilee is Gamla. Those are the Zealots. We've got Bethsaida. We've got Chorazin. We've got Capernaum. Right over there, that's the religious Jews towards the top. You can always also see that right where they're at, that's where the Mount of Beatitudes is. That's where the Sermon on the Mount takes place. Like right in the region where all these people would have been. It was on a desolate hill, but it was near villages. You've got the Magdala. Who's from Magdala? Mary Magdalene, right? So she's from this town right here. We've got a big mountain called Mount Arbel that's right next to Magdala. And then you've got Tiberias. So Tiberias and Magdala are separated by a mountain that you can't get around. So when you talk about Herodians and then Jewish people, there's a mountain in between them, kind of separating them from each other. So here we go. We're going to just put these up so you remember them again. Something's going on. It's pretty sweet. It's all cool. It's one of those nights, right? All right. So we got Triangle area. We've got Capernaum. We got Chorazin. We got Bethsaida. All of them right here. And then remember, we've got Susita. So if I say Decapolis, you say what? Pagans, right? So let's try it again. Decapolis. Pagans. Susita just happens to be one of the 10 Decapolis cities. Deca 10, Polis city. So 10 cities. Then you've got up to the top, you've got Gamla. And if I say Gamla, what are you going to think of? Zealots, right? That's where the Zealots are at. And then if we come over here to Tiberias, who do we think of here? Herodians, people who are Jewish, but they look very Roman. So they dress like Romans, they talk like Romans, but they're Jewish. So Herod himself was Herodian, claimed to be Jewish, but he was really Roman more than anything. And so the people who are there, such as his sons and the other people, they look Roman, but are Jewish by birth. And then we've got up here on the top, the triangle, Chorazin, Capernaum, and Bethsaida. These are the three cities or villages, we want to call them, because they're not very big, where Jesus does most of his teaching and miracles. Are going to be in this section here. A couple people last night asked the question, why are there different spellings of things, like Chorazin with a K or Chorazin with a CH? The reason for that is because the real spelling is in Hebrew. And Hebrew doesn't use any English letters. And so this is called transliteration. It's whatever you think it sounds like. So for a guy who can't spell like myself, it's fantastic. You just say, that's what it sounds like. And you just put up whatever you want. All right. So here we go. The triangle, as you can see, it's all very close together. And then we put up this map last night, too, just to kind of show you the topography. The Sea of Galilee is still 700 feet below sea level. So it's a long way below sea level still, not as far down as the Dead Sea. But you've got this area here, and this is where a bunch of people, a lot of Jewish people, when they came back from the exile, they came and they set up shop, built their homes in this area because it's very rich with agriculture. And so they created an environment to live in here. We talked about a couple different people groups last night. Who are the people groups who spend their time inside of the synagogues? What's the religious grouping of people? The Pharisees, right? Sadducees are in the temple. Pharisees are in the synagogues. And that's why Jesus battles with them so much, is because they're the religious teachers of the time to the common people. And who's attracted to Jesus? The common people, because he's a common person. So you have these dialogues going back and forth, and the Sadducees are pretty far off on their teaching. Most people don't really side with them, but a lot of people like what the Pharisees have to say, and I think that's why Jesus engages them so much, is because they're the closest to getting it right. And there's a lot of things that they also say that are right, that Jesus, he makes known of, like, yeah, that's correct. Do this and you will live. You know, you've got the right answer. And then there's other moments where Jesus steps in and says, no, that's not correct. So we've got this map that we did. We showed you the Decapolis area again. We've got the Decapolis here in the pink. This is controlled by Rome in the first century after Herod dies. Archelaus, his son, controls Jerusalem, Bethlehem area, and Samaria. His son Antipas controls the area of the Galilee and down below. And then his son Herod Philip controls the northern area up where Caesarea Philippi is. So you've got a bunch of different people controlling the areas, but you've got the Romans who are controlling the Decapolis, and they're doing that. Archelaus, just so that we can get it into our heads, he's a very bad ruler. Herod was very, I'm not going to say Herod's a good guy, but he was a good ruler as far as Rome was concerned. Archelaus is not very good at ruling anything, so therefore, in the time of Jesus, Archelaus is kind of like a lame duck kind of guy sitting there, so who do they bring in to ask questions to? Pontius Pilate. So Pilate, who is controlling the Decapolis, has now made his way over here and is taking care of issues because our good friend Archelaus is not able to do it. So Pilate is stepping in and controlling that region more so. All right, we're ready. Here we go. Back to our map right here. Remember yesterday how we finished up talking about the Jewish school system? We talked about kids would go until the age of 12, till their bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, and they would go and learn. And if they were good enough, they would move on to the next level. And if they weren't good enough, they would go and learn the trade. Every kid learned the trade. It's just a difference at this point of whether you're doing the trade full-time or you're still going to school. And if you were really good, you'd study until you're about 15 or 16, and then you would go find a teacher or a rabbi in the area who you agreed with how they taught, and you would go ask them if you could follow them. And if they said yes, then you would follow them potentially till the age of 30 until they then commissioned you to go and make disciples. So this is kind of the strategy of the schooling system. And so we get to this moment with the guys, and Jesus shows up on the shores of the Tabgha area. Let me just show you again where this is at, since I've got our map right here. What we're looking at right now is, you see Capernaum on your map? Just a hair to the left. This is the port, little section of what's called Tabgha. And Tabgha is a location that means, it basically means seven springs. And in Hebrew, the area is called Ein Sheva, and Ein means spring, and Sheva means seven, so the place of the seven springs. In Greek, it's called Tabgha. So the fishermen base out of this area because there's all these little hot springs right there off the right off of the area where the picture's at, and the hot springs are right where this jetty is, and that section there, and people would fish there because there are a lot of fish would come to this area, little minnow-type fish would come to this spot. And so this was a big fishing spot. And if you were going to go fish and get big fish, you would take your boat a little bit further from where Capernaum is, and you would take it to where the Jordan River comes in. Because that's cold water, fresh water coming in. And in this spot here is where the bigger fish would be. And so what archaeologists have found is that all the fishing remnants show a lot of fishing there, and then a little bit of fishing over here near Ein Sheva. Don't think about going out in the deep water. They weren't into that. That was too scary for them. We don't have time to get into this, but the Jewish understanding of hell is Leviathan and down into the depths. And so there's always this feeling that deep under the water, down in that area, that's where hell is. And they didn't want anything to do with it. A lot of scholars even claim the fact that most fishermen probably didn't know how to swim because they didn't spend time in deep water. They stayed near the shore. And when you see the size of the boat, you'll kind of understand that a little bit more. So if you've got your Bible, open up to Luke chapter 5. And we're going to look at a couple little moments here. Luke chapter 5, verse 1 says this. One day, Jesus was standing by the Lake of Gennesaret. Again, that's another name for the Sea of Galilee. So it's known as the Sea of Tiberias. It's known as the Gennesaret. It's known as the Sea of Galilee. you can, there's a lot of names. It's kind of like Hume Lake. People have names for the lake. If you, you know, were somewhere else, you might not call it Hume Lake. We call it Hume Lake. The guys staying in the campground probably call it the place that brings mosquitoes their direction. Everyone just has a different name. Depending on where you live, you call it something different. If you lived in Tiberias, it's the Sea of Tiberias. Really funny, there's no sea. It's just a little tiny lake. But when you look at Israel, there's not much water, so this thing looks massive to them. It's the biggest freshwater source in the entire region. So one day, as Jesus was standing by the Lake of Gennesaret with the people crowding around him and listening to the word of God, he saw at the water's edge two boats left there by the fishermen who were washing their nets. He got into one of those boats, the one belonged to Simon, and asked him to put out a little bit from shore. So we got to think a little bit about fishermen for a second. Fishermen would come into the late of the night. So they'd come about 12:30, 1 a.m. in the morning. They'd come out there and they would fish from that late part of the night because it's a hot, hot region. So you got to go when it's cooler because that's when the fish are like more active. And you would fish through the night and you would be done in the morning. So by the time the morning rolls around, when the sun comes up, you would be done for the night. You would bring your stuff in, you'd wash your nets, you'd put it away. And then as a fisherman, you'd probably go home and you'd do a little bit of other work around the house, maybe some farming or a little bit of agriculture stuff. And then you'd go to bed and then get up late in the early in the morning again and do it all over again. So these guys have been fishing all through the night and they haven't caught anything, as we can see here with the storyline. And Jesus shows up to a place, and again, scholars believe this is the location. He shows up and the guys are washing their nets and people are listening to him talk. He's new to the scene. People are just now hearing about this guy from Nazareth, and they're coming around to hear what he has to say. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to put out from shore. And he sat down and taught the people from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deeper water, and let's put down the nets for a catch." All right, we got to get into the moment here. Simon's caught nothing all night long. Him and his buddies, nothing. Jesus shows up and starts teaching, and so now they're cleaning their stuff, and this crowd of people's coming in, and I can imagine they're kind of getting frustrated about that. But at the same time, maybe listening into what this guy has to say. Next thing you know, the guy's in your boat. "Hey, buddy, get out of there." And he's just making himself at home, sitting in it. And then he asks Simon, Peter, to pull out a little bit so that people can continue to sit there and listen to him. So as people get closer and closer to the water, he's now sitting in a boat, and now Peter's sitting in the boat. And he's probably having to like do a little bit of work to keep this boat like in a straight line so Jesus can talk. Who knows how long Jesus talks? He's a Jewish guy. Probably went on for hours. He finishes up. The people leave. And then Peter's like, "Oh, I mean, Jesus, man, that was a great time. Let's go out and fish." Peter's sitting there going, "What are you talking about? There's no fish right now. This is not the time to fish." But Jesus just says, "Hey, let's go fish." And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deeper water and let's let down the nets for a catch." Simon answered him, "Master, we've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything. But because you say so, I will go let down the nets." Now, the types of fishing like I was telling you about, in this area right here, what boats would do is they'd go about 100 yards off of the lake. So say that this is the shoreline right here. They'd take their boat about 100 yards off, if that, put it this way, parallel to the shoreline, and then they would let down a net on one side. Then what you would do is one of your guys working with you from the shoreline would scare the little minnow fish towards the nets that are hanging off of the boat. Tiny little net, very skinny. You'd catch the little guys, pull them into your boat, and that's how you'd fish from there. If you're fishing in the further out part, you would go out. It would take a little while to get there. And then you would go out into the deep, deep water, which here again in the text from what we're seeing, he doesn't go very far offshore. And then you would drop the big nets to be able to catch the bigger fish that would be coming in that area. So you would drop them low, try to catch them, and then scoop them back up. So Peter goes out, he drops the nets because Jesus tells him to do so. When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So they signaled to their partners on the other boat to come out and help them, and they came and filled both boats full, and they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell to his knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord, for I'm a sinful man." For he had and all his companions were astonished by the catch of fish that he had taken. And so were James and John and the sons of Zebedee. Then Jesus said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on, we will catch men." So they pulled their boats up on shore and left everything and followed him. Wrong net, wrong spot, wrong fish. Wrong time of day. But I love how Jesus meets these guys in the place where they're at. They're professionals. And he comes in and he's not going to leave anything to chance. It's not by chance that we just caught fish. It's a miracle because I am who I say I am. And these guys in this moment are going to leave everything and go and follow him. Let's jump into Matthew because Matthew gives the same account and gives us a little bit more information so that we can fill our story in a little bit more. Matthew chapter 4, verse 18. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon and called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come follow me, Jesus said, and I will make you fishers of men. And at once they left their nets and followed him. Going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat and with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets for the next day's catch. Jesus called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. So we get two different accounts here, which is interesting. We get one from the side of going, Peter sitting there, he's going to get schooled by Jesus. I love that. And then the other one, the guys are like, we're not going to go into the schooling of what happened. We're just going to go into the fact that we left and went with him. A little bit of saving face, maybe, who knows. But we get this moment, and I love that about the sons of Zebedee, their dad, they leave him, and he's okay with it. Like I told you last night, I'd be frustrated completely if my boys just left me with all the work. But these guys didn't make the cut. They weren't the smartest of the smartest, or they would have been following somebody else. They had done their schooling as best they could, and now they were working for dad. And this guy shows up who's making a stir in the Galilee, and he asks them to follow him, and they go. So this is kind of the starting piece that Jesus is going to grab some fishermen, he's going to grab a tax collector, he's going to grab a couple zealots, he's going to grab some different people to come be a part of what he's going to do to potentially change the world. And as we know, it does. Here's the size of a boat. All right, so you need to see this one. It's not very big. And the reason that we know that this is the size of the boat is because they found an ancient first century boat right there in that location that was buried under the mud. Really cool story of the archaeologist pulling this thing out, showing what a boat would have looked like in the first century. So it's not very big. You could maybe fit four people, maybe five in one of these things. So now you understand where it says in the scripture, and we're going to read it, that when Jesus goes out into the other side of the lake or whatever with the disciples, multiple boats go with him because they can't all fit in the same boat. So they're taking a couple different boats. And these boats, the one that they found, this one, is made out of seven different types of wood. Because wood's hard to come by in Israel, so they were using whatever they could find to piece one of these little puppies together, and then they were using tar and a bunch of other materials to like kind of glue it all together and keep the water from coming in. So this is the ancient boat that you can see if you go to Naf Gennesar in the Galilee to this day. Anybody been there before and had a chance to see it? It's pretty cool to walk around it and just, you know, get that feeling of, wow, this is what a boat would have looked like in the time of Jesus. All right, so here we go. For someone who was asking, this is Beth Shean. Remember we talked about Beth Shean a couple days ago, the Decapolis. This is the capital of the Decapolis. It is a giant Roman city. It's huge. But I just wanted to show someone because they were asking about where Beth Shean was. But here's our talk for the day. So open up your Bibles. We're going to have some fun. Mark chapter 4. If you take a look on your map, remember that place called Susita? This is Susita right here, this hill right here in the middle. Also, this is my favorite place to stay in Israel. It's called Engev. It's a really nice hotel. Anyway, right up here above you, this is Susita, the Roman Decapolis city of Susita. And it's going to come into our story in just a second. And you can see how the Romans, they like to build things that are very hard to conquer if you were to try to go attack it. So there's really only one way up. It's going to be up the front side or up the back side, and it's going to be very steep. They brought in water from 16 miles away on an aqueduct to bring water into the city. And then what's amazing when you're there is that they took rock, because that's all they have, and they channeled like holes through it, and that's how they made pipes. And so they had these pipes that brought water into the city. They had fountains flowing. I mean, when Rome does something, Rome does it well. And you'd go to this city on top of this hill, and there would be water, there would be just like trees and oasis, and this is Rome. Rome comes in power. Big city stuff up there, a big temple to Dionysus, a big temple to Zeus. And so everybody in the Galilee can see this place. If you're sitting over in the Jewish quarter area, the triangle area, you can see this. And Josephus talks about it in his book. He says that in the evening sun, as the sun would begin to set, the nice temple of Dionysus sitting up there would reflect its marble brilliantly for everyone to see. So everybody, everywhere in the Galilee, could see this place and see the temple of Dionysus sitting on top of this hill. So this is Susita. Again, we understand this is where the pagans are at. Let me give you another picture of it. This is a shot looking at it from a helicopter looking down. And you can begin to see here that they've uncovered an amphitheater here at the bottom of, and this is if you were to come up to it, this is as close as you can get to the water on the plateau. You had this amazing amphitheater that people would be able to sit and be able to watch shows. As you go further back, you've got a bunch of temple areas back here. And then further back, the city continues to expound itself. And then this is all city in this area too that has not been excavated yet, coming down the other side. I love going there because every year there's something else that they dig up and they find, and you just go there. And with my students, it's a secret because most people don't go to this place. They cover everything up after they excavate after a summer, and we bring our water bottles and we just like dump it on the ground and kick our feet on it, and all of a sudden you see marble tile and all the coolest things. You know, and the students are like, "You're allowed to do that?" I'm like, "Yeah, just cover it back up when you're done." You know, and you just see them all wasting all their water all over the place, like uncovering every mosaic they can find. Yeah, it's pretty fun. This is another shot from the back that we took. And so you can see this is the approach up onto Susita. And you can see like it's got a perfect view looking down towards the Galilee. Straight across here, it's kind of hard to see it, but like right over here, this is Tiberias, the city of Tiberias. So it's not a very big lake. So you can see everything. And again, Rome is sitting there in power. For anybody in the Galilee to know, Rome's in control. And they're sitting up on top of this hill. Couple last things. These are just some of the ruins when you get up there. You see this, these marble columns? It's ridiculous. It's like going to Rome. Marble like this doesn't exist in Israel. So they brought it all the way over from Italy. It was quarried and done over in the Roman Empire over near Italy. And it was brought all the way over to the Providence over here. And they built this up. So everywhere you go, like our students and people we take, we just go sit on these, you know, to do our talks. And you're sitting on this old awesome piece of marble that's just laying there on the ground, left over from the city. Mark chapter 5, but we're going to start in chapter 4. It says here, again, Jesus began to teach by the lake. Oh, what do you know? We're on the lake. The crowd that had gathered around him was so large that he got into a boat. Where have we heard this before? He's pulling the same old move again, but this time Peter's ready for it. So a crowd comes and he gets into a boat and he sat in it on the lake while all the people were along the shore in the water's edge. He taught them from many things by parables and in his teaching. And so we're going to begin to see a bunch of different parables here. The first of them is the parable of the sower. Why do you think he's using a parable about farming? It's a farming area, right? It's agricultural. Next one is the parable of the lamp on a stand. Again, he's using everyday things around them to be able to tell them these stories. Another one's the parable of the growing of the seed. Another one's the parable of the mustard seed. He's teaching them with things that are right there. That's what I love about chapter 7, well, actually 5, 6, and 7 of the Sermon on the Mount. You can just imagine as you sit there, Jesus just pointing to things and saying and talking about them. He's the master teacher of using what's around him so that people can understand it. He finishes up, and it says this at the end. With many similar parables, Jesus spoke the word to them as much as they could understand. He did not say anything to them without using a parable. But when he was alone with his own disciples, he began to explain everything. That day, when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side." Oh, man. If you're a Jewish kid or somebody who's like knows this topography from the first century and you're told that, you're sitting there going, "Hey, we don't go to the other side. We don't make our way over there. That's where the Gentiles are." And Jesus just casually makes this statement, "Hey, let's just go to the other side. Let's head on over there. Let's go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up and the waves broke over the boat, so it was nearly swamped. Now, people always ask this question, is there really waves, you know, on the Sea of Galilee? Yes, it's crazy. I've been out there multiple times. Because the Sea of Galilee is 700 feet below sea level and you've got mountains on both sides of it, You've got the Golan on the east, and you've got Mount Arbel on the west. The wind blows down, and it just bounces around down inside this valley. And almost every single night, that's why my favorite place is this hotel right here, because as you sit here, you have an amazing view of the sun setting, but you also have all the waves coming in because the wind blows that direction and then makes waves coming in. I watch people sitting there, you know, trying to body surf. I mean, the waves are decently big. I've been out on boats before where we've been out in the sea and we had to stop because the waves were getting too much for these tourist boats that we were on. My last sad thing about it is I've been trying to wakeboard the Sea of Galilee for 14 years. And I have yet to be able to do it because every time I rent something, they call me back and they go, sorry, it's too choppy now. Come on. Just need to walk on water one time on a wakeboard. But a storm comes up. These are fishermen. These are guys who know the water. Again, like, they get freaked out. That's why, again, a lot of scholars believe that potentially these guys don't know how to swim. So we get this moment here, and it's one you've heard multiple times, but it's a great one. It says, a furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Remember how small that boat is. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. I used to think of a giant boat. Jesus isn't, like, on a giant boat. He's right in the front. He's sitting there. Water's coming in. It's not like he's not in the way. I mean, people are bailing water out, and they're like, come on, Jesus. It's not a time to take a nap. When I get to heaven, I've got questions for him. One of those is, were you pulling what I do as a dad? Were you pretending to be asleep and you're watching to see what your kids are going to do? But anyway, he's not responding to them to the point where they're afraid. They need him, and they're kind of mad. They're kind of frustrated at him because he's not helping out. And he said, teacher. Again, that's important. They don't call him God. They don't call him Lord. They call him teacher. Don't you care if we drown? He got up and rebuked the wind and said to the waves, quiet, be still. Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? They were terrified and asked each other, who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. I think it's interesting when Jesus steps into our professional worlds where we know everything and does something to where we can't explain it. You have to start asking questions at that point. These are fishermen. They know the tendencies of this lake. They know this lake gets big with waves. And all of a sudden this happens, and they know that it doesn't just stop. And this guy, who they call a teacher, just told the waves to die down. They're having to recalibrate their thoughts of who Jesus is. He's beginning to show them what it means to follow somebody who calls himself God. Now, I'm sure these guys are sitting there going, right on, Jesus. You said, let's go to the other side of the lake. And what happens? We're not supposed to be there. A big old storm. So let's go home. But Jesus is like, no, we're not done. We're going the other side. So they're going to keep making their way across. And if you look again at your map, I'm just going to scoot back a little bit here. They're going from a place right here, Capernaum. And when it says going across the other side, they're making their way to here. So it's a kind of an angled shot across. It takes a little bit of time. Typically, fishermen in that era, they'd stay on the shoreline. But Jesus takes them right out there on the waves, and he takes them right across. And they're going to a place that Jewish boys and girls don't go. You don't go to the other side. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. Bum, bum, bum. Everyone's like, oh, no, the Gerasenes. That's Susita. That's Decapolis. Where Jesus got out of the boat and a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. Right on, Jesus. We told you this was a bad idea. If the disciples haven't wet themselves from the storm, they are wetting themselves now. And they are all climbing back into the boat. I can imagine, like, land, land. Oh, get back in the boat. We don't like crazy Larry who just showed up. And so now this encounter is about as they've gone all the way across. They've gone to the place they're told not to go to. They've gone to a place that Jewish people don't spend time. They've made their way across, and all of a sudden, Crazy Larry shows up, who's a guy who's been down in the area of the tombs. So let's look again at our picture. If your city is up on the top, your tombs are down here on the bottom. You don't bury people inside your city. That's just gross. And so you bury them outside of the city. So Jesus shows up on the shoreline right here, which is another reason why I love this hotel. because I can sit and teach this teaching right from our hotel. Jesus shows up on a boat, and the moment they get out of a boat, a guy hanging out in the tombs over here shows up. And this is the type of guy that maybe you, growing up, had someone like this who lived on your street, who had you had stories about him or her. I remember as a kid, like, we were always scared of this one house on our street, you know, and it was like, don't go over there. That person there, like, took a kid when they were trick-or-treating, and they never came out ever again. You know, like, just the stories. Well, this guy's got stories too. I mean, this guy, as we're going to see from the Decapolis side of it, from the pagan side of it, these people don't like this guy. He's an outcast of their society. He's the guy that they tell stories about, and all of a sudden these Jewish boys get out of their boat, and there he is. And he comes up to Jesus, and look what he does. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with chain, for he had often been chained hand and foot. But he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. This is the guy that the town doesn't know what to do with. They've tried. Now they're just letting him be content living in the tombs. This is the guy who shows up to meet them. Night and day, among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he began to run towards him and fell on his knees in front of him. And check out what he says here. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" What did the disciples call him a minute ago? Teacher. This guy knows who he is. I love that moment here. The disciples are still learning. This demon-possessed man knows. When you're confronted with Jesus, even the demons quake in fear, and they know who Jesus is. And so he runs at him, and he says, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God that you will not torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send him out of the area. He uses a name here, Legion, which is a Roman word. There is a legion sitting on top of this hillside that works for Rome. This is where they're stationed. Their flag for this legion is a boar's head. Dionysus is the big temple on top of it, and the way that they worshipped Dionysus is they sacrificed pigs. In Israel, the way that they worshipped Yahweh is they sacrificed goats or lambs or pigeons, kosher things. So we talked about this the other day. You can tell if a place is following God from the kosher side of the Levitical law by what the archaeologists find as far as the bones. Over in the Galilee, up in Chorazin, places like that, they didn't find pig bones. Here, they found a ton, and they'd expect to, because these guys worship in a way that uses pigs as a sacrifice, and they also eat them and use them as food and commerce and a bunch of other things. And so we're going to see how this plays out. But this guy uses the word legion because that's, again, describing this place here. And again, we're getting this moment here that Mark is doing where he's making a statement, again, depending on how you want to interpret this, that this is about Roman power and this is about God power. So if this guy is legion, that name represents Rome. Who's going to win? God or Rome? The demons or God? I mean, we got a lot going on here, again, from a Jewish perspective reading this. And it's great. A large herd of pigs was feeding on a nearby hillside, and the demons begged Jesus, "Send us amongst the pigs. Allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank and into the lake and were drowned. Big things happening here. The pigs are probably grazing somewhere over here on this hillside over here. And 2,000, let's put some perspective here. The entire town of Capernaum or Chorazin, they would have all of their animals together because, again, it's a family-oriented place. And so you might have 100 sheep in a village. That's everybody's sheep. That's why it's a big deal in the story when Jesus says one sheep is lost. You go find that because that's the well-being of the community. One sheep's a big deal. It's somebody's sheep. So to have 2,000 pigs over here means that this is just not a food thing. There's something bigger, business-wise or temple-wise, going on. This is a big number. It's an economical engine, or at least it's a religious piece where all of these pigs are going for a reason, because you don't need that many just to feed people. So 2,000 pigs. And when Jesus casts out the demons, they go on the pigs, and the pigs go running straight to where? To the lake, right? Remember what I told you from a Jewish perspective and even from a Greek perspective? We talked about Caesarea Philippi and how the gates of hell was that waterway going into the underworld. Again, from a Jewish perspective, of course they ran over there. They went back to hell. That's what a Jewish person would insinuate hearing that. And these pigs just go and they drown themselves. All I can think about is 2,000 bloated pigs just floating in the lake, and who's going to clean that up? Yeah, gross. Not a good day. Fish were probably happy. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. So imagine you're in charge of these pigs, you're a servant or whatever, and this goes down. You've just lost all the pigs. You're going to go tell people about it. Hey, it wasn't our fault. The pigs ran off on their own, the demons and all this kind of thing. So those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there dressed. Okay, so he's been naked before, so I didn't put that into the storyline. Dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Here's a man for who knows how many years has been tormented by demons. He's tormented people, and the town comes back, and there's Crazy Larry sitting down next to Jesus. He's actually wearing clothes now. Who knows? Maybe even trimmed his beard. I don't know. He's sitting there. I can just imagine he's got like the dreaded comb-over haircut going on to cover up a bald spot or something that he had ripped out. And he's sitting there having conversation with Jesus. What's he talking about? I don't know. If they're Jewish, they're probably talking about politics, hummus, or soccer. So probably talking about one of those things. But they're having a conversation. And people are afraid. This isn't normal. Crazy Larry is normal now? What has happened? And you'd think that the response would be, that's amazing. But to the contrary, it says this. Those who had seen it and told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told them about the pigs as well, then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. They care more about the pigs than they care about somebody who just had their life changed. But that's life. I mean, I feel that too. Like, I think a lot of times we care more about business. We care about these other things rather than a changed life. And they tell Jesus to leave. And so Jesus, he does what they say. So as Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. And Jesus did not let him, but said, "Go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he's had mercy on you." So the man went away and began to tell everyone in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. This trip seems like a waste. They come over, they brave a storm, Jesus calms it. They step out of the boat, Crazy Larry shows up. He casts out demons, the pigs run into the water, everyone comes out and is yelling, a riot's about to start, tells them to leave. They get back in the boat. Crazy Larry shows up. "Please take me with you." "No, Larry, stay here and go tell people what God's done." This guy's got no theology. This guy doesn't know much at all about Jesus, but he has a story. And he leaves. And Jesus leaves. What a waste. They get in the boat and they head back to the other side. It says that they get to the other side, and it says, when Jesus had gone to the other side, they crossed back over on the boat to the other side. The lake, a crowd gathered on that side waiting for him of the Jews. And then one of them, and it's going to be the raising of the dead girl and taking care of a sick woman. So Jesus just goes back on with ministry. Chapter 5 finishes up. Chapter 6, we get into John being beheaded. We get Jesus sending out the 12 disciples to different places to go begin to do some ministry. We get into this awesome moment where the disciples still aren't getting it, where Jesus is going to feed the 5,000 right over there in the Capernaum area. So the religious triangle, Jesus is going to sit there and he's going to feed 5,000 people. And the disciples are going to learn in their disbelief who this Jesus is. Jesus is going to walk on water in chapter 6. He's going to talk about clean and unclean in chapter 7. And then all of a sudden, it says this, chapter 7, verse 24, of Mark, Jesus left that place, so the Galilee region, and went to the vicinity of Tyre. Tyre and Sidon are in Lebanon today, so up on the coast. So he leaves and he makes a long trek, several days, and he goes up into Tyre and Sidon and he begins to minister to a bunch of different people up there. And then in chapter 31, it says this, verse 31 of chapter 7, then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon down to the Sea of Galilee and then into the region of the Decapolis. Second time he's been there. First time, over to the region of the Decapolis, crazy Larry. Nobody wants to talk to him. What a waste. Second time he heads over, in the beginning of chapter 8, it says, during those days while he's there, another large crowd gathered, and since they had nothing to eat, Jesus is going to feed 4,000 people. Feeding a 5,000 over in the Galilee area of the Jewish people, feeding a 4,000 people over in the Decapolis. Why in the world would a bunch of pagans even care about a Jewish guy to come out and sit there long enough that they'd have no food? I can't claim this. This is going to be a Jesus thing when we get to heaven. We're going to ask. But I have a feeling Jesus is sitting there teaching and sitting out in the crowd. He makes eye contact with one crazy Larry who looks at him and just under his breath says, I brought some friends. I don't know, but we know that the storyline of crazy Larry is that he goes and tells people in the Decapolis. No one cares about hearing about Jesus, and all of a sudden, a few chapters later on his second return, everyone is there. My point to that tonight for us is that your story matters. When we don't understand what God's got going on in our life, what he's doing, he does. What a waste. Get on the boat. Come over. One guy. We almost died. God's like, you don't understand what I'm going to do in chapter 8. And that's a good thing for me because I feel that so many times. When we live in the world of like training up our children and we live in the world of our training up our grandchildren and praying for different people and so desperately wanting them to see them follow God, God's got a plan. And for you sitting there too tonight who goes, I don't got much to offer, you've got a story. It might not be crazy Larry's story, but you've got a story. And God can do powerful things with that. They cross back over to the other side and Jesus is going to continue to do miracles. And from that point on, you're going to see every place that Jesus teaches, there are a lot of different people there. And Jesus is going to start to proclaim this whole concept that the gospel is not just for the Jews, it's for the Gentiles as well. I'm going to give you one last one as we finish up tonight. If you want to open to just a little earlier in Mark chapter 2. A few days later, and this is, again, let's leave the storyline alone. We're not in the storyline of the Decapolis anymore. This was previous to that. A few days later, when Jesus again entered Capernaum, so he's been gone, he comes back to Capernaum, this is becoming his home base, the people heard that he had come home. So many gathered around there, and there was no room left, not even outside the door. This is Capernaum here, and this is the synagogue of Capernaum, and that's what I call the Millennium Falcon. That's a spaceship. Underneath that, that's a church actually, so I should probably be more cool about that. Underneath that church, it's got a glass bottom, and you're looking down on what is believed to be Peter's mother's house. That's pretty cool. You know, like again, we got some stories that occur with that. And you can see these other homes here, you know, inside of this place. Because remember, the synagogue's the most important central part of your village, and you have all your homes around it. This is a kind of a view from the ground here, looking at these different remnants of these homes. Made out of a basalt rock. You can see the Sea of Galilee in the background right there. This is what a home looked like in the first century, made out of rock. It had an outer court to it, and then as you would go in, it'd have a smaller living area, and we can kind of see the cutouts kind of looking at that a little bit. You heard in one of the videos we talked about, like the whole idea of Jesus going and preparing a place for us. It's the same concept in Jewish times in the first century is that when a son was going to get married, he'd come back to his father's house and he would build onto it. And dad would be the one to make the decision when it was done. So he'd be building onto the house and dad would be like, that wall's not good enough, you know? build onto it a little bit more. He'd be like, hey, you need to make that look nicer. You need to plant some plants or whatever you need to do. And finally, dad would finally say, it's time, go and get your bride. And we get some of those storylines again in the New Testament where it says that no one knows the day, only the Father. Same concept. The parable of the 10 virgins, you got to be ready because you don't know when the bridegroom is going to come to get you. And so these are what homes would look like. And this is a picture here, of me sitting inside of a home that's been kind of reset up. And you can see that it's very small, it's very narrow. Everybody lived in kind of the same area. And then above it, they're going to use the only wood that they have to make some cross beams. And then they're going to put some little branches or reeds across that, and then they're going to put a bunch of dirt on top of it. That's your roof. You're replacing your roof quite often, especially if you have a decent rain. And these are what a house looks like. And so back to our story here with Jesus. They heard that he had come home. So this is Jesus's house that we're talking about. Whether he's renting it, owns it, I don't know, but this is Jesus's house. So many gathered there, and there was no room left, not even outside the door. And he preached the word to them. Tons of people around, tons of people in the house, all these people there. I love getting a group in there and smashing them in. And then I love having people on the outside, like yelling, trying to get in. It's just kind of a fun part to bring the story alive. And then it says this. Some men came bringing a man who was paralytic, carried by four of them. Since they could not get him to Jesus because of the crowd, they made an opening in the roof. In Jewish culture, you take care of the widows, the orphans, and the people who are less than you. And so these friends have probably done everything. They've probably taken him to every doctor. They've taken him to everybody who said they could help out. They've done anything that would work. And it hasn't worked. And all of a sudden, this guy by the name of Jesus is teaching in Capernaum area, and he shows up. He's back at his house, and these guys are like, this is our chance. We're getting him there. They load the guy up and they bring him. But when they get there, they can't get in. Believe me, if they're going to cut a hole in the roof, they probably tried to get in multiple different ways. Probably a fight almost started. They probably tried to push their way in. And they can't get in. And so these guys go on top of the roof and they begin to dig with shovels to dig away the dirt. And then after they dig with shovels, they begin to pull apart all the different little branches that are there, and then they're going to lower him down through a part where the big beams are not. I love what Jesus says here. It says they began digging in the roof above, and Jesus, and after digging through it, they lowered the man, the paralyzed man, and he was lying on his mat, and they lowered him through. And when Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, son, your sins are forgiven. Imagine us sitting in a room and people are digging in it and all the noise on top, and imagine all the people shouting, because again, this is first century Jewish culture. They're not afraid to tell people what they think. And so they're yelling back and forth, and Jesus is letting this roof get destroyed. He's letting it happen. Dirt's falling on everyone's faces. It's coming down. The roof that he lives in is getting destroyed. I hope he has good homeowner's insurance. And they lift it up and they drop the guy down. There's two things that stick out to me in this story. One, are you the type of friend who's willing to do whatever it takes to get people you love to the feet of Jesus? That was chutzpah. That was not the ordinary. And Jesus makes a statement not about the paralytic. He says, when he saw the faith of these men. And that's convicting to me, because in my life, a lot of times I think it's like, I got to pray for this, I got to pray for that. What about my faith? In my life, is Jesus going to look at me and go, because of the faith and conviction of Rich, I'm going to heal this guy over here, or I'm going to take care of this, because this guy believes and these guys are willing to do whatever it takes. And so they drop this guy in. Then the other question is, a lot of times it's easy to be the guys who like rip the hole in the house and drop the friend in. What about the friend? Are you the type of person that's going to let your friends get you to the feet of Jesus when you need someone to get you there? I think that's the harder one. The harder one is when you're in that need or in that place to let someone take you there. It's humbling. This guy's already his whole life probably been made fun of and mocked, or just had that life of not having, you know, been able to walk. He's paralytic, and now all of a sudden he's the show of the day. Oh, remember when George got dropped through the ceiling down on top of Jesus and they ripped the... He's now that guy. And so I think there's another piece to it of going, Are you the type of person who is willing to get your friends to the feet of Jesus and do whatever it takes? And are you the type of person who will let your friends get you to the feet of Jesus and do whatever it takes? Again, when you see the pictures and you understand the house and you understand that Jesus lets it happen, he's using this moment to completely show people what it means to live in community. What it means to live in community is to love your neighbor as yourself and to go to whatever extent it takes to get people to the feet of Jesus. I've got other ones, but I want to finish this off here at 8 so that you get done on time. And I want to pray for us, and I want to give you a chance to ask a couple questions if you want to. But it's been a privilege to open God's Word with you guys. I mean, I get a smile on my face every time we get to dive into this because it's just so vibrant. And it gets me every time. I mean, I walk away going, man, I need to do better at that. And that's the best thing about God's Word, is it continues to sharpen all the time.